Thanks a lot. Welcome everyone to the Ashland Park and Recreation Commission Senior Ashland Senior Advisory Committee, ASAC. We're meeting electronically today, and most folks are here. And I want to appreciate everyone showing up this afternoon. It's 3:30 on January 10th, 2022. And first on our agenda, we have approval of minutes from the November 8th, 2021 meeting. I'd ask for a motion to approve unless there's any corrections or comments that need to be made.
I move approval. This is Sandy.
Yeah, hi, Sandy. Second from anyone? Raise. Okay, very good. All in favor, why don't you just signify by raising your hand for approval? Okay. Minutes are approved into the record. I don't have any late moment additions or deletions from the agenda. So I realized that Eileen advised me that there might be some folks not on the subcommittee watching, and this is the time for public input. Is there anyone not on the subcommittee that wishes to speak on any item? I only see committee members, so I'll assume that that's a negatory on that, which will incredibly quickly launch us into item number five on our agenda, which is the housing and homeless solutions in Ashland. We have Linda Reed, housing specialist from the city of Ashland, with us. And I think I'll turn it over to Eileen. Did you want to do a brief introduction?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you very much to Linda Reed for joining us today. Linda is the housing specialist under the City of Ashland Planning Department, and she works on housing issues and it helps. She is also staff to the Housing and Human Services Commission. So, and been very involved in the shelters, the emergency shelter things recently. So thank you, Linda. I'll let you unmute and share with us.
Hi, thank you, Eileen, for that introduction. So as Eileen said, my name is Linda Reed. I am the housing program specialist for the City of Ashland. I work in the planning department. And some of you, I think I've met before, and some of you I probably haven't. So I am just going to provide a very brief overview of the City of Ashland's housing program. It can be very as in-depth as you would like it to be or not, just depending on what areas of interest you guys have. So I wanna leave a lot of time open for questions or to dive into whichever pieces of this you guys have the most interest in. So do please feel free to raise your hands or ask any questions as I go through. And I do have a PowerPoint presentation. It's pretty brief. Can you share screen with me, Eileen?
You should have permission to share screen, Linda. See if you've got that at the bottom.
Oh, I see it. Here we go. Yep. All right. So bear with me, everyone, because I am absolutely horrible at running these sorts of things on Zoom. Okay, I think I did it.
You did it.
Okay.
So like I said, I'm just going to go over this very briefly, but stop me if you have any questions or specific questions. And I'm actually just going to do the 30,000 foot overview. So I'm not going to go too in depth into things. I would start off by saying that the City of Ashland Housing Program encompasses a number of activities that promote and regulate the development of affordable housing within the community. How do I make it go? Let's see here. Oh, there. Okay. The Affordable Housing Program provides financial and regulatory incentives and requirements that promote the development of needed housing types. And on this slide are just some examples of what the city's affordable housing program provides. So mainly on one side are the financial incentives, which include grants, such as community development block grants, affordable housing trust fund grants. In some instances, the city has donated land to nonprofit affordable housing providers to help get the development of affordable housing. The city will also waive certain fees. System development charges can be waived, engineering and community development fees, and then the school construction excise tax. And then the city also has, on the other hand, these land use policies that promote the development of needed housing types, and in some cases require the development of needed housing types. So a couple of things that we have that just, you know, help make it easier for different and smaller housing types to be developed are the cottage housing ordinance. We have a streamlined ARU, ADU process that makes it a little easier to get through, fewer barriers, lower cost because of the time. We also have an affordable housing density bonus, and that allows private market developers and affordable housing developers to provide more affordable housing in certain circumstances. And then we have some requirements for annexation, zone changes, and condominium conversions that would compel affordability. So essentially, it is seen that the developer is getting a benefit for what the city is providing, and in return, they have to provide a community benefit, which the city sees as affordable housing. Let's see here. So on the other hand, the other big part of my job is to administer the Community Development Block Grant Program. So the City of Ashland is an entitlement jurisdiction for Community Development Block Grant Funds, which we receive directly from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The city receives between $175,000 and $200,000 a year. And we can use this money to support activities which address the objectives and goals of the CDBG program. So in this slide are just very broad brush strokes of what HUD is looking for with the CDBG program. In a nutshell, the national objectives tell you which populations and under which circumstances you can assist organizations. And then the goal is very broad, and under each of these categories, it is actually very well defined what sorts of activities can be undertaken. So the development of viable urban communities, principally for low and moderate income persons, through the provision of decent housing, suitable living environments, and expanded economic opportunities. Decent housing obviously refers to safe, affordable housing. Suitable living environments is really about, public amenities and sidewalks and parks and ADA access. Expanded opportunities is really about economic development. So I think good for us, and I think this always comes up in every presentation I have, to just visit the terms affordable and workforce housing, because I think there's always a lot of confusion about what these terms mean. So HUD has an actual definition for what affordable housing means. And according to HUD, the definition of affordable housing is that a household doesn't spend more than 30% of their income on housing costs, which can include certain utilities, but just for the sake of ease to say housing costs. So when we talk about affordable housing, what we often talk about is that the certain income groups are not spending more than 30% of their income. But what HUD really means is 30% of anybody's income, right? So it can be high income people or very low income people. HUD's programs are always targeted to median to low income people. And so their definition is really about that. And it brings in the regulatory piece, but we won't go too far into that. Workforce housing is another term that people use, and it doesn't have a true definition for HUD, but it does sort of speak to that group of people whose incomes are essentially too high to qualify for many of the subsidy programs that are available, but then they really don't earn enough to also afford housing within the market. So that's generally what is meant when people talk about workforce housing. And the city's affordable housing program, well, I could backtrack a little. Many of the structures of the city's housing program mirror the structures that HUD has set up for the CDBG program for ease of administration, consistency for staff, and so that our program will align with some of the HUD funding as well. Because of that, the city's programs often use the same measures. So this is an example. This is something else people are very often very interested in. The income guidelines that the city uses for the affordable housing program are the income guidelines that the Department of Housing and Urban Development establishes for metropolitan statistical areas, like what is Medford and Ashland together in Jackson County. They're actually all the same. And so these are the income guidelines. They are updated every year annually based on American Community Survey data and a formula, which is easy to find on the HUD website. So the city uses this same income guideline for our programs to be consistent. HUD programs, as I said, would only target people below 80% of area median income. And so the City of Ashland's housing program actually picks up where that leaves off. We do have options for very low income people in the below 80 and even down to 30, but mostly we have options that go between 80 and 100 and 120% of area median income, which is often considered that workforce housing group. Does anyone have any questions about these income guidelines? I know that this just is something that people find interesting, and I never can state them in meetings unless I have a slide like this, because they change every year. And so I don't keep close track of them. But they also are by household size. So that's the other thing. Oh, Eileen.
I've heard sometimes people have questioned, like when the new units went in on, Mountain and East Main, for instance, and people heard the purchase price. It just makes me curious, if you were at the 80% level or so, and you were going to have a price that was no more than 30% of your income, how does that translate into kind of what the top value height house somebody could purchase? That may be more than you could do on the top of your head.
I couldn't give you that calculation, but what I can say is that the City of Ashland's affordable housing program actually has a formula to calculate that. And in that formula, there are built in many assumptions, some of which are a correlation between the number of bedrooms in a unit and the size of the household. So as you can see, our programs all would look specifically at the number of people in your household. For our formula, we actually take a range. So for example, for a two-bedroom unit, we would say, that a household of between, two and four could live in a two-bedroom unit. So if we were targeting 80% of area median income, we would take the average of a two-person household at 80%, a three-person household, and a four-person household, and we would consider that their maximum annual income. And then we work our way backwards, essentially. So we say they can only, if this is the average income of this range of households, then they can only pay 30% of their household income to housing costs. And so what is the maximum price that they could afford to pay based on the amount that they could pay each month? And we build into that formula the loan costs, any insurance or HOA taxes. So we just work our way backwards to get to a number. So part of the city's housing program is that I work with developers to deed restrict units. We record those deed restrictions. If we've given them a financial incentive, we would also record a promissory note and a trust deed to secure that funding that we have given them. And then we essentially set the maximum sale price. And we say that, when this unit transfers, it cannot sell for more than this amount, and we deed restrict who the home can sell to. So it has to sell to a target income, which in certain circumstances, the developer can choose that target, generally from a low of 60 to a high of 120%. So that was a really long-winded answer, but it doesn't come with a number necessarily, but I hope that gets you to where you were.
I think that might explain why affordable housing units could calculate out that a sale price was 300 or 330,000. It sounds like it should be completely out of the range of affordable housing, but because of all these variables, including family size and the percent and on all of that. So it's just surprising sometimes when you just hear the end result and not the whole calculation.
Well, and I should clarify that those units on East Main and Mountain are not affordable housing units. People, I think, use the term affordable housing loosely. Mm-hmm. They might be more affordable, but so when I say affordable housing, I only am referring to units that are deed restricted through some mechanism that will maintain them as affordable over time. And we'll talk a little bit about that in the next couple slides, but really it has to do with just either city deed restrictions or through the state or federal government because there's some sort of funding from them in that development.
Great, that will be great to clarify. I think some of us heard in the news that those were going to be affordable, but apparently not by definition. And
right.
I can't remember what I heard at this point. Okay. I see Mike has his hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the question. So these guidelines are specifically for home purchase. It doesn't have anything to do with rent guidelines for amount of rent people pay. Is that correct?
No. So these guidelines are established by HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and they are used for all HUD programs. So in rentals, if a household, and we'll skip ahead a slide and we'll look at something else here.
Okay.
So this is the list of regulated affordable housing units in Ashland. And that goes back to that piece that I talked about where I only refer to affordable housing as units which are deed restricted or regulated to be affordable. So you can see that all of these units in these lists have a number next to them. And this is the target income for the households that can reside in these units. So households, for example, at the Donald E. Lewis Center, people who live there cannot make more than 30% of the area median income for their household size. And so that does correlate back to that income guideline, and so people have to qualify at those income levels. For the city's program, we do have deed restrictions for rentals, or we have the provision for rentals to exist in our program. The majority of the units in our program are in fact owner-occupied, and obviously they can all be sold just like anything else, but some are actually deed restricted to be rentals only. And many, which are owner occupied, can also be rented. And so we do have a, within our resolution, we set a maximum rent amount for the units. And it is essentially based on the income level that can reside in those units, that those units are deed restricted to rent or sell to. And our rental units are actually not a formula like our sale price. The rental units are pegged to another HUD program, which is called the HOME program. And like the income guidelines, HUD issues updated home rents every year, about at the same time that they do the income guidelines. And so HUD is trying to correlate all these things at the same time as well to make sure that the households who reside in these units are not income cost burdened or housing cost burdened.
One quick follow-up, how long do the deed restrictions usually last?
So for the city's program, it traditionally has been a sliding, not a sliding scale, but it is different for different programs is what I should say. So the city's first affordable housing program was the SDC deferral, which began in 1992. That program had a 20-year period of affordability, but also had the ability to essentially pay off the loan with interest and buy your way out of the program. Strangely, we didn't have a whole lot of that happen because that 20-year period wasn't the same housing boom, I think, as we've experienced more recently. And then in 2004, the city updated our resolution and at that time changed the SDC program to be a deed restriction of 30 years with no buyout. So that unit had to remain affordable for that period of time. With regard to annexations and zone changes specifically, the city made a 60-year period of affordability for those units that are brought into the program under that regulatory requirement. And that time frame is seen as long-term affordability. The city just recently updated our resolution again because it hadn't been updated since 2006. And now we have a little more complicated structure where rental units can have a period of affordability of 60 years, but home ownership units that come in as annexations or through a zone change process would actually only be required to have a 30-year period of affordability, with the recognition that standard mortgages are for 30 years and that one of the barriers we were removing was the difficulty of transferring properties with such long-term affordable housing requirements on them. And then there is a payback that diminishes between year 30 and year 60. And it looks like you have your hand up too. And I have to say, I can't see all of you at once. I can see four of you.
Okay, I've got two questions, Linda. One of them is that the income, standards or whatever that you're showing are national standards. Is that right?
So yes, they are, but they are specific to your region.
Oh, okay.
So HUD sets them nationally. But each region has different income guidelines based on census data for your area.
When you say region, how big is that region?
For us, it is it's two things, but they are not different things. It is Jackson County, or it is also called the Medford-Ashland Metropolitan Statistical Area.
Okay, all right, that's fine. And then the second question is that there are really two barriers to seniors occupying who are low income occupying quote affordable housing. One of them, of course, is cost. The other one is whether or not the design is universal design or so-called age-friendly design. So the funnel seems like it would narrow, not just because of the number of affordable units, but also whether or not they're safe and accessible for older adults or anybody who has some challenges with mobility or anything, vision or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good thing to bring up. And I went back to this regulated affordable housing unit slide so that you guys can see, and I don't have this on here, but you may already know, some of these units are, or some of these complexes are specific to seniors. Ashley Senior is one, obviously. Donald E. Lewis is another one. Which other one is in here? I think that's it. Just those two are senior specific, and you probably already know this, but units that are seniors, are for seniors, can allow some people who are not seniors in them, but they can't allow very many. It's a very small minority of people can occupy units in a senior complex if they are not seniors. However, seniors can live in any complex. So all of the other units would be considered family units or, I think they're almost always called family units, except for Star Thistle, which is really for people with mental illness. So seniors can live in any of these, but I think, Anne, what you are pointing out, and I think is probably pretty obvious, aside from Donald E. Lewis, Ashley Senior, I think, was built in the early 80s, maybe. And probably, I mean, I have been there, but I know they're upstairs units. Honestly, it's just older. And I feel like back in the 80s that, you know, universal design probably was a phrase that no one uttered ever. Well, not no one, some people, but lots of other people were not talking about that at all. There are two new developments, or three, where is it? Hyde Park, which is only six units, which was completed in 2011. That complex, I know, specifically has ADA units in it and ADA visitable. Most of the large scale affordable housing developments that take place are funded through Oregon Housing and Community Services through a variety of funding sources, some of which come from HUD and some of which are tax credit programs. And Oregon Housing and Community Services does require some ADA amenities in new development. So for example, Snowberry 2, I took a tour of that. I think Steph Steffinger was there as well. And they talked a little bit about some of the things that they incorporate that make their units more visitable, ADA visitable and more friendly to people with differing abilities. I suspect that there are a few others, like Rogue Ridge, which is in the process of being built, probably has more of those amenities for that very reason. So I think we are starting to see more and more of that, but you're absolutely right, and that many of these older complexes, they were not built with those things in mind, and they do not include those amenities, and I don't think that there is a retrofit for them. There is a process through fair housing called reasonable accommodation, where tenants in any rental housing can request a reasonable accommodation for whatever need they have. It doesn't have to be granted by the landlord, but the landlord has to consider the request. In the instance where like physical alterations have to be made to accommodate someone, the person who is requesting the accommodation would be required or responsible for paying for that that physical change, and then for paying for that change to be undone, essentially, when they vacate that unit, if that makes sense. And I don't know that really addressed your question. Cost-wise, I think, you know, most seniors tend to fall, or not most, most many seniors tend to fall in the, you know, lower income area, the 50 to 30 AMI, especially as they have more of a fixed income. And, you know, I used to work for the Housing Authority many years ago, and one of my jobs was to do income reviews. And I rarely ever saw, I mean, mostly it's one person household, sometimes two people households, but I was rarely ever out of, I rarely ever saw anyone with Social Security that was outside of the 30% of area median income, which is the lowest income.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see here. I feel like I got a little bit off track. So I'm just going to touch really briefly on homelessness, or maybe not really briefly, because it's not something we're able to touch on too briefly. The city of Ashland, as I said, is an entitlement jurisdiction for community development block grant funds. And there's a couple of things that come into play when you receive community development block grant funds. One of which is that you are required to complete what's called a consolidated plan. The consolidated plan is essentially an assessment of the community's needs and a plan for addressing those needs. And through this process that HUD prescribes, you recognize what those needs are by doing this fairly in-depth assessment. And then you put that all together into a document called the consolidated plan, and you send that to HUD. And essentially that document is your five-year strategic plan for how you will use this grant application for grant funding. It's your grant application for this funding. And it just identifies a range of activities that you could do. But one section of that consolidated plan is entirely about homeless populations. And there is, as I put in this slide, a very large component of HUD's goals that specifically address what are called presumed benefit or limited clientele populations. So people who are considered to be low income without having to go through an income review process to identify them as low income. And homeless people are one of those populations that are considered a presumed benefit. So through this consolidated planning process, you identify the needs of your homeless population. And the way that you do that is through a regional coordination. So what I wanted to say about that is that the City of Ashland does not own or build or manage any housing at all. So all of the grant funding that we receive through the CDBG program, we are really beholden to nonprofit organizations and community partners to provide for the needs that we identify through this consolidated planning process. And a lot of that is for homeless populations. But like I said, we don't build homeless shelters and we don't provide services to homeless people because that's not our role, but we do provide funding to those entities that do. And obviously in Ashland and in any community, as we're seeing, there are just more needs that can be met with the amount of funding that we have and with our local limited resources and the limitations of the individual nonprofit organizations. But to try to meet this need, it takes a regional coordination and interagency cooperation to bring together these scarce resources and address these complex community issues. So regionally, the city coordinates with an entity called the Jackson County Continuum of Care, which is a group of governmental and nonprofit agencies and is also an entity that is required by HUD to receive homeless funding or funding for homeless services that the county receives and that we in turn in the city also receives through that process. And one of the things they're required to do is take a point in time count, which some of you may have heard of, which is a one night count of the number and subpopulation of the homeless population within your community. And then we also do what's called the housing inventory chart, where we identify the number of beds and the subpopulations to which those beds are allocated. And then we work as a region to sort of match those numbers together. All of that is and all of the other work, the affordable housing work as well, is known as the continuum of housing. So essentially, you know, we have people who are unhoused, we have people who are precariously housed, we have people who are stably housed, and we have housing units that match those different, not enough of them, but that are theoretically matching those different populations. And so our job is to try to figure out where do we need more housing in that continuum as a region and how do we plan for that in the long term and also regionally with the funding that we have, not only within the city or the funding and resources, but also within the county and in the state and how do we get that all targeted together. So that's kind of the quick version of the crazy umbrella of how homelessness is addressed in our community and even to some extent in Ashland specifically. So that is actually the extent of the presentation that I have for you, but I'm happy to answer questions or go in depth into anything. And then I also wanted to say, and I can send this to Eileen to send out, that this is the link to the city's housing program page, where there is just a lot of different information, including brochures on the housing stock in Ashland and also how the housing program works and a lot more like granular information about that. There's a PowerPoint presentation on it. And also there's a landlord tenant page, which people really find interesting. So
Linda, we'll get all your slides from you. So people may want a lot of that great information. We'll do that and we'll post it with the minutes as well.
And would you like me to stop sharing and I can see you all, or are there things that you guys would like to refer back to at all?
I think maybe you can stop sharing. I think that would help.
Great.
So I'll just start out. We have about 10 minutes. We can have question and answer. I had a quick question on the HUD money that comes from the feds. Does it trickle down through the state, through the county, and then finally to the city, or does the city get that directly from the federal government?
So there's a few different pots of money that come from the feds. The city does get a direct pot of money from the feds, which is the Community Development Block Grant Funds. The state of Oregon also gets Community Development Block Grant Funds that we are generally not able to access because we get our own. So it's seen as other communities that don't get their own, that's money that they can access. And they would apply through the state through an application process. Because of COVID, we received a lot of extra funding. Everybody did through the CARES Act. And some of that money, which the state has, they are making available to entitlement communities because there weren't enough subscribers in non-entitlement communities, to expend that funding in the timeframe allowed by HUD. There are other funds, though, that come from HUD. So there's a fund called Emergency Solutions Grants. Those go directly from the federal government to the state of Oregon. And then from the state of Oregon, they are given to community action agencies to then provide to homeless service providers. So in that case, it comes from the state for us and goes to Access. And then from Access, it would go out to Aura or Rogue Retreat or Hearts with a Mission. And it's essentially anyone who's providing some sort of shelter or other homeless services. And then there are there's a few other funds that come that way. Jackson County, the county, I'm sure they receive some money from like Oregon Health Authority, but they don't receive any homeless funding directly or any housing funding directly.
Oh.
However, I should say that Jackson County, if anyone wants to apply for funding through the state, for CDBG funding through the state, they'd actually have to have Jackson County as the applicant. Jackson County has to agree to be the applicant for them because they are an entity that can receive that funding.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Kathy. You're muted.
So a couple questions. Are there, I don't know if you would have the answer, how many or affordable units are under construction right now, and how many are in a permitting stage?
Actually, sadly, I do have that because it's not ever very many. So right now there are 30 units under construction. I think Snowberry Brook, which is 60 units, Snowberry Brook 2, I think they're done now. I mean, I know that because of the housing crisis, they have been slowly as building, because their units are in buildings, separate buildings. So as each building gets completed and gets their certificate of occupancy, they have been going ahead and making those units available to get people in them right away, even though the totality of the development has been completed. So I feel like now, as they've been doing this process for a little while, they may have a few units hanging out there, but that they're primarily completed. The Rogue Ridge development, which is 30 units, and some of you may have some familiarity with it. It's on by the Starbucks on the corner of Ashland and Walker, but back in. Oh, it's actually right around the corner from you guys, from the senior center. So that development is still under construction. And then we do have one planning application or planning, it's been approved, it's not an application, a planning approval, which is moving forward, which is a public-private partnership between Habitat for Humanity and KDA Homes. And that is, oh man, where is it actually? I don't think I know where it is in physically, but it will result in 5 units of affordable ownership housing. And so that one is currently still working through the planning process, and they haven't broken ground, but they you know, it's moving right along. And then Corey, yeah, thank you. Corey asked a question about how many total units are there. So right now, I am counting Rogue Ridge. They have not been completed. So, you know, but I am counting them because we know that they will be completed. And I haven't counted the five. And so in the list that I provided to you guys on the screen, those are all units, but including Rogue Ridge and Snowberry 2, not the other five. So of those units that are, you know, as I said, deed restricted, so they have to be affordable, there are 406 total. And that's both rental and home ownership. But I have to say, it doesn't include, so these are all units that can be rentals, but it doesn't include all of the units in the city's program that are only in the city's program, which is probably another ones that aren't in here. Well, I don't know, not that many additional ones, but they're mostly accounted for. But that is less than 5% of our housing stock. I mean, if you think about, you know, the, I mean, 406 sounds probably like more than you thought existed in the city, considering the need, but it's not very many, considering how many households we have.
Any other questions for Linda? Go ahead, Natalie.
Thanks, Linda. Is there a wait list or something like that? Or what's the occupancy or vacancy rate, I guess, of the affordable housing units?
That's such a good question. Vacancy rate is like the hardest number to get at. And there's like two main ways that we get at vacancy rate. One is through the census, which is very slow and behind. And so census probably says that we have something like a 4% vacancy rate. I mean, less than 5 is terrible, but anecdotally, we have less than 1%. So the other way that we get at it, and this is the most interesting thing, and some of you may already know this, so there's an organization called the Southern Oregon Rental Owners Association, and they have monthly meetings, or at least they used to when they met in real life. And it really is a lot of rental owners. And so what they would do is at the beginning of every meeting, they go around their big giant room full of rental owners and they ask them how many vacancies they have. And they come up with a vacancy rate through that process. I have not spoken with them. I don't know how their meetings are going. In other meetings that I have heard, that it really is closer to 1%, especially for affordable housing, not just, you know, I mean, what I would call market rate, which includes some units that are affordable, by the way. They're just not, you know, regulated to be maintained that way, so we wouldn't call them that. With affordable housing units, the housing authority said, oh man, I can't even remember it. They have had to close their wait list for Snowberry because it was already 3 years long. Hyde Park had a 3-year wait list as well. These are highly desirable units because they are guaranteed deed restricted. So some of you know that there's a thing called a housing choice voucher. It used to be called a Section 8 voucher. So that's one way to get affordable housing. And that is offered through a local housing authority, like the Housing Authority of Jackson County, which is our local housing authority. People apply. You have to be very low income. So you have to be that 30% of area median income or below for your household size. You get on a wait list, which is 3 to 4 years long. And when you get your voucher, you have theoretically 60 days to find you a unit that's going to rent for the maximum price that is the subsidy that they can provide for someone within your income. Generally, that is around $850, $900 a month, maybe a little more for some other people, but most of the time it's right around there. The issue is that private market rents, non-regulated rents, are higher than that. It is very difficult for people who have those vouchers to find a unit that they can rent with that voucher. There is now an exception, I think it happened maybe a year or two ago, where they allow it one extension. So you really have up to 120 days to find a unit and use that voucher. If you can't get under contract within a rental unit, you lose your voucher and you have to start over and get back on the beginning of that wait list and then wait that 3 years again and hope that the housing market is better. So the one place where you can always use your voucher is in a regulated affordable housing complex, because those have the right rents and they're not going up. So it's often people who have the voucher already who are trying to get into these regulated affordable units because they're almost the only units on the market that they can use their voucher in. So that creates another real driving factor for these limited, you know, units. Eileen?
And I'd like our ATEC members to know that we're pretty familiar with the two senior housing, you know, Donald E. Lewis and Ashland Senior Apartments, and we hear about other senior apartments in the county, and they are typically on a 2 to 3 year waiting list. Sometimes if people are willing to apply for ones in other areas of the county, they are more likely to get a call in less than 3 years. And of course, we tell people to get on all the lists they can because they never know. It could be a 3 year waiting list, but the day they offer it, nobody wants it and it goes down to your name. But it's a long, slow process and not something to, it's not going to handle your emergency housing needs. And we do hear from people whose situations are changing and boy, they are not going to get into something affordable in a fast way.
It's a real challenge. I mean, the housing piece is a real challenge. And I mean, you may or may not know this, but the City of Ashland's housing program is actually very robust for a community our size. And it's actually a lot more than a lot of other communities have done in the past and are doing now. Recently, the City of Medford has enacted a lot of changes. So they have a much more robust housing program. You know, we've been deferring SBC since 1992. Most communities don't do that at all. Some communities have just started to do that. We have an affordable housing trust fund. That's a very rare thing. The community development block grants are a nice incentive, though we don't receive a huge amount of those, so it's not as great. And then our regulatory pieces. The other piece that I didn't really cover is that I'm here, and that is something that a lot of affordable housing developers really appreciate, is that I'm the person in the planning department that they talk to, and if there are issues or if they're looking for a piece of land or, you know, whatever is going on because they're considering, you know, building some affordable housing, then I am tasked essentially to try to make that process a little easier for them. I get to communicate with planners and with them and to say, hey, look, what are you looking for? How can we help you out? Because really what we're trying to do is encourage more of that regulated housing type so that we can have more places to use the vouchers or for people who have low incomes to live. Because we know that this is the thing that we need more of. And these are all of the resources within our limited control that we can sort of throw at this problem.
You know, Linda, we really appreciate you coming to talk to us today. I think it helps the community to have your services and definitely appreciate the explanations on not only how seniors are involved with the housing issues, but overall, it's a very welcome presentation. I'm going to try to wrap it up a little bit so we can get on with the other items on our agenda, but I'll let Natalie have a shot at something.
Thanks. Sorry, I just wanted to point out that there are two questions in the chat. They should be really quick. Anne asks if someone can be on a wait list in multiple cities. And Linda Peterson Adams asks you, Linda Reed, if you've been involved with the new project at Croman Mill.
I have not been involved. I mean, I have heard about it. But we haven't gotten quite that far, and I'm sure, actually, I think I was told that the group that is involved with Croman Mill is scheduled to reach out to me soon so that we can start discussing the ways that the city's programs can dovetail with what they're wanting to do. And sometimes what that looks like is what they're wanting to do isn't exactly aligned with our program, but we can give them enough incentives or, you know, I mean, essentially, you know, we have this little balance and we're saying, well, what will tip that balance for you to make you provide that thing that we really want? Is it a little bit of money? Is it a little bit more units? Like, these are the things that we have to offer you, you know, what combination of those things can help make that happen? And if that doesn't work, you know, we just guilt them into it. No, I'm kidding.
Good job.
Well, thank you all for having me.
Real quick, Anne's question, if someone can be on a wait list for in multiple cities,
yes,
for a voucher.
I recommend that to people. I mean, I try to be respectful of the knowledge that it costs money to apply. However, I'd say please go to those places. I mean, you could give them a call and find out what their wait list is like. If they have a shorter wait list, you know, maybe that's something you want to get on their wait list for the housing authority and access, not as much access because they have fewer units, but the housing authority, they have a lot of units. They manage a lot of units. Of course, most of them also have wait lists, but you can call the housing authority and find out, you know, what the wait lists are. And, you know, you kind of have to hedge your bets with the applications, but absolutely. I mean, it's a scattershot thing and you really just got to like try to get as much out there as you can. And I wanted to let everyone know that you can always email me or call me directly if you have any other questions.
Great. Thank you very much again for coming to our meeting today. We appreciate it. And we will probably reach out to you when we need you.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you all and take care.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Linda.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Excellent presentation. Hopefully we got what we needed out of that. Next, I'm going to turn it over to Eileen for an overview of local utility assistance programs.
Thank you. I'm going to share my screen a little bit. I haven't prepared my slides. It's been a little too busy lately, sorry. But along the lines of what we've been talking about lately, there's been a lot of interest in the committee about what are the services in our community for our low-income residents. And it is complex. You know, that is the nature of our society, that you don't go to one place and apply for everything you need. You have to apply at 20 different places that each provide one service to you. And for those of you that are helping your friends and acquaintances or wonder how we help people, I know Natalie and I have been learning this for over 3 years, 3.5, 4 years, and we learn something new just about every week. So what I want to do is fill in that picture. We didn't have time for another whole presentation today, and I better do a little time check here. I haven't done my calculation. Do we even have this time left, Michael?
Yeah, we can do it.
Okay, cool. So what I thought I would do is share my screen and take you to the city website. So give me just a minute to navigate to that. Where is the utility? Okay, I'm going to have to find that. Sorry, I thought I had it saved. Give me just a moment. If I'd been more prepared, I would have had it up. Okay, this should do it. Oh gosh, I'm so sorry. I had it on my other computer. This is the problem with changing computers all the time. I'm just going to use this one. So, the city has a constellation of assistance programs, and all of the city's utility assistance focuses on the utilities that you see as Ashland residents in your Ashland utility bill. If some of you have gas utility in your house, you know that you have to get that from a separate organization called Avista. And of course, for our garbage and recycling, we pay yet a different one, the Recology. So for people who have gas, Those people would go to the organization called Access that Linda referenced earlier. Access works on housing and utilities and food. So they are a big player in our county. But I want to run you through what the city offers. So you can see on this page, it talks about applications for the low income, the ALEAP, Ashland Low Income Energy Assistance Program, is accepting applications through January 31st. In bold here, you also see the senior utility discount, and you see the emergency heat assistance. So this is part of why it's really complicated. Natalie and I have been trained. Before COVID, we would sit down sometimes with seniors and help them apply in person. People can request an application from the utility billing office and fill it out themselves, and then they take their income documents in and they get verified at the counter. But we're aware that for some people, standing in line at the counter is a tough one. These days, the utility billing office mostly isn't open. I think people mostly drop off their forms at the door. So, and we've had that same challenge, but we will at some point go back to qualifying people in person. So for seniors, this is where we usually start. It's available for income qualified persons who are 65 and older, or if they are disabled, with a formal disability status, with Social Security, and age 60 and older. This is a very low income bar. So you heard Linda talk about area median income earlier. There another income bar you might have heard about is the federal poverty level. And I can bring up a chart of that in a bit if there's interest. But we talk about 100% of poverty level, 125%, 150%, et cetera. And those are national standards that they aren't adjusted locally, which is why the housing folks use a locally adjusted number. It doesn't make a lot of sense with poverty when you think of how much more expensive some areas are than others. But this uses the federal poverty level because typically, this is subsidy money that has been channeled through the feds to Access or another avenue, and it all comes with rules. So these rules are not generally made up at the local level. They're following rules from whatever the money source is. But this is a wonderful assistance for people who qualify, depending whether they're at 100% or 125% of poverty. They may get a 20% or a 30% discount on their bill all year round. And what's really nice with the senior one is they get it off the entire bill. So those of you that read your bill, you know your electric that you used that month is actually just one portion of your bill. You have all these extra charges. So it's really wonderful for seniors to get 20 or 30% off the entire bill. And this is something we often check in when we're hearing that people are having financial trouble. Do they have utilities in their name and have they ever applied for this? Because this is one way to bring their monthly expenses down. As a senior, once you qualify for this, you automatically qualify for additional assistance in the winter. And that's what this ALEAP is. I wanted to give you this presentation in January in case you know of anybody who's struggling. By the way, Mike, if you see that somebody has a hand up, let me know, because I like Linda, I can't see everybody while I'm presenting. This is, as we know, your winter bill can be very expensive. And so the city has an additional program. This turns out to be money that is channeled through Access to local utility providers like the city of Ashland. And so in this program, they're following the Access guidelines, and it's, I believe this one might be on the median income that, Natalie's putting her thumb up for me. This one uses a different qualification formula, but the bar is much higher. It's quite a bit higher in this one. So they're up to 65% of Oregon's median income. If you remember earlier, Linda was showing us She was showing us the 30% of medium income. The federal poverty level down here is more like that 30% of median income. So 65% is quite a bit higher, with the idea being, if you're this poor, you need help all year round. But if you're in a slightly higher bracket, you maybe only need help in the winter. And by this is how they stretch the dollars, right? Now, this has a lot of rules. People can receive a maximum credit of $300 for the winter. And if you're in that senior and disabled, so you've already qualified at this lower income level, you can get a credit of up to 50%, and you get up to 6 months to use that, right? So you could have $50 a month off your bill over 6 months. So others, you know, so this might be a family, might be at a higher income level, they can get up to 50% off their bill for 3 months. So it may not cover all of somebody's utility bill, but it gives them some help. And they do prioritize seniors and people with disabilities than others. And people, the application process usually starts, I think October, November, Natalie, is it November 1st? It comes out in October for November 1st?
I think it starts in October, end of October.
Starts the end of October. So just keep in mind, I can see that this one I pulled up is dated. It is open until 2022. Either somebody forgot to update this or my search brought up only something very old. But that's the gist of it. It's the same each year. Then there is a third program. So this is what happens when you get behind on your bill. You know, maybe you have that extra high bill, something happened, maybe you had a medical bill that month and you got behind. It can be very difficult for a low-income person to catch up once they're behind. And so this is a third program the city offers, I believe. I'm so sorry, I can't get my phone to stop ringing here. I believe that, have you ever seen you can round up to make some donation with your utility bill? The city has that option so that those with means might want to contribute to help others who don't have means. And this is one of the places that money goes to help people who have gotten behind. There's a few rules with this. Typically, the city requires that people get their bill down to just $100 left. They can get it one time per year. Depends on whether they have money in that account. So those of you that can afford it, go ahead and do your roundup. So it has a bunch of rules, more than I want to go into at this point, but it can help people bring their bill back down to zero. And then what we do and what the utility office does as well, there are some nonprofit organizations in our community that will help people get to this. So Access typically has some funds for that. St. Vincent de Paul has some funds for that. Sometimes ORA has funds for that. So sometimes by the time somebody reaches out, they've got a shutoff notice and they owe $500 or $600 on their bill. And we help educate them that they need to communicate with the utility office and let the utility office know that they're working on it. And then we give them the numbers and they start calling around and they see who has money, because those organizations, their funds run out. Lately, it's been pretty good because of all the COVID and fire assistance. Most of those organizations have had a little more money to help people. And then what they'll do, if your bill was, you know, $522, they might come up with $422 for you. That leaves you with $100. The city will give you that $100 and you'll be back down to zero. And meantime, we're all talking to you about, are you signed up for these other things so that you don't get in the same tight spot again?
We have a couple minutes left.
I wanted to stop there and take questions, but I see Natalie has something she wants to add.
If I could just share another document, there's a good one pager that summarizes the income.
Oh, thank you, Natalie. That's all good. I couldn't even navigate to it.
Let me see there we go.
We have our internal document, but
this is the one, this is for this current year. And so you can see by this is the energy low assistance, the one time, the winter credit, where it's $31,000 annually. It is less than half of that for the senior and disabled year-round discount, and it is a little bit less than, you know, 50% between those two for the one-time assistance. So there's a real range of incomes covered here.
Thank you, Natalie.
Excellent. You know, Sandy had a question earlier. She has her hand down now. Sandy, did you want to ask something of Eileen? No.
Having trouble unmuting, looks like.
Okay. Is there any other questions for either Eileen or Natalie regarding this? There isn't a single person in the city that you go to, right? It just goes into the billing, utility billing, and whoever.
Utility billing is pretty helpful giving people guidance, but we do get a lot of calls on this, and we do our best to kind of help people figure out how to navigate it.
Yeah. Can you unshare that screen, Natalie, please?
Thanks. Can I just see, was that helpful for the committee? Was that kind of information useful?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, very good. I don't want to try to leave things too early, but if we want to finish by 5, we might as well. Move on. So thanks, Eileen, for that update. And I'm sure anybody that has questions can reach out to both you or Natalie for future help. Next, we'll move on to some standing reports. First up is APRC. I'm just going to be brief. APRC has been spending a lot of time looking at long-term funding options. Some of you have probably heard that discussion going around. We've asked certain things of the city council, but at this point we're kind of in a holding pattern, waiting for the city council to move forward with some a city survey they would like to do, which Steph might want to talk to a little bit. And I really don't have anything else from APRC that directly pertains to seniors, so I might turn it over to Steph Steffinger from the City Council.
What we're looking at is we don't have enough in the budget to pay for everything. And there's been interest in having a clearer definition from the public of what it is that are their priorities within the fact that there's some money that's general money, some money that can only be used for certain things, and some money, a lot of general fund money goes to essential services, which are police, fire,
admin.
Yeah. So what of those essential services are also considered value services? Like, you don't necessarily have to have, for example, a fire prevention program, but Ashland does have somebody assigned to that. And looking at whether when we're looking at those finer points of what could maybe charged in a different way, or for example, an example of this would be we have, through the FireWise program, have had people observing and looking at homes and helping people know what they could do to reduce their fire risk. And we had professionals doing that at one point. Now we're training volunteers to do that because the money for that is a little bit, is another one of those things that we're looking at to try to determine if it's essential or not, essentially. We have big projects coming up, water treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plant, and what we do for the climate action and our reduction of carbon. Again, trying to find out which of those items are most important to the citizens is one of the things that this survey is supposed to provide to the council. The other thing about it is that we're trying to do more of letting people, hopefully this actually happens, knowing if we're giving money to something, where that fund is, and what is actually going to cost for that, so that people can understand and prioritizing also high cost items versus items that are not as expensive to reduce. So anyway, that's kind of a general idea. Are there questions?
Any questions for Steph? All right. You're off the hook. Right.
When is that survey coming out?
Well, it's being developed now by Southern Oregon University, and it will then go to the council to be sure that there are the items that different counselors are feeling important to have on that. I don't know that there's a specific timeline that I know of anyway. Sooner than later, certainly.
Probably
next budget process.
Probably late spring, I would say, from what Councilor Graham was saying the other day. Hopefully it would go out by May, you know, so that they could get results back and hopefully evaluate what the responses are by the end of summer.
I would say the other thing that's important with that is people that respond are generally people that are highly active in a commission or have a particular project that is important to them, and really it's important for us to hear from everybody, because we always hear from just a few people, and so a lot of our decisions are based on that. So when you get the survey, fill it out, send it in, get your friends to do it, especially those that are not always on social media and who we don't really know what they want.
Anne, you had a question?
Probably more of a comment. I mean, I just have no idea whether people know that are involved in this actually know how to structure a valid methodology. And so I have some skepticisms and concerns about whether it will yield what is hoped for without the emotions or the weighting of people with loud voices. And then I don't know whether we have any way to make sure that issues related to senior services are included. And I'm sorry, I had to step out for a minute. So if you already talked about that, fine. But those are the two things I would be concerned about.
I'm concerned about that too. I would say get all the people involved, get senior people involved from the senior center, get communities with retirement personnel, North Mountain, involved. That's really one of my concerns anyway, is that I don't know, some of the council seems to feel that parks should be a department rather than its own entity. And the entity that's always, that has recently been looking for out for senior needs is the parks. It's not the council. So that's, you know, we hear a lot about homeless needs. We hear a lot about homeless needs. We don't hear a lot about what seniors want. And that's, you know, your voices are going to be important.
Well, I would hope their methodology would weight responses on the base, you know, do some income, age, and other race, you know, all of those things, at least the livability survey through the National Citizen Survey that has been offered every couple of years, may have experts who actually know what they're doing the weighting, because otherwise it's not representative.
Well, you know, what I would suggest is that maybe the senior advisory group might want to make those kind of statements to the group that's developing this and be involved and say you want to be involved.
Well, maybe we can have a letter. Do we have to get a, Mike, do we have to get a vote to find out if the ASAC members wish to have a letter go to the designers or the council or whomever, or Livable Ashland for that matter, to have input into the process and make sure that it is in fact going to be a representative sample and not skewed to special interest.
Let me address that real quick. The Ashland Park and Recreation Commissioners are already crafting a letter that's going to be sent to the council requesting hopefully a seat at the table when the questions are discussed, to make sure that the areas that that the Board of Commissioners for Parks has control over, the senior program being one of them. I think an adjoining letter from this group would be more than welcome to go along with what ATRC is already doing. So I don't know that we need to take a vote on that. I think we could craft something and you know, and just tag along with ATRC. I'm going to recognize Mike first, and then Eileen had her hand up. But go ahead, Mike.
It just seems to me that we are behaving exactly like one of the special interest groups, because that's what we are. We're a special interest group. And what tends to happen is that each of the special interest groups tries to mobilize response. The vast majority of Ashlanders who don't belong to any special interest group, they're the ones surveyed. However, SOU has a pretty good reputation for doing things like this reasonably properly. And so they'll probably get a better representation. But the question is, if one wanted to be objective, where does Parks and Recs belong? That's an issue all by itself. Then you get, should senior services be under Parks and Rec, or should it be under something else? Those are the kinds of things that we pay professionals to deal with. And just being another special interest group waving our flag, I don't think that's really what's the best interest of the city of Ashland. Maybe the best interest of Senior Center, but it's not in the best interest of the city of Ashland.
Eileen, did you want to comment?
Yeah, on a few pieces of this, I see Linda Peterson Adams has put in the chat that it's SOU that is designing the survey, and I think I've heard mixed opinions about that. But you should know that it is going to be mailed to every home. Tanya Graham came on an APRC meeting and explained that it is going to be, if not every home, maybe it was a scientific sampling of every home, but it is
every utility user.
Every utility user. But she did say it will be important for the city and all partners like us to do outreach to as many constituencies as possible to encourage them to look for that in their mail and fill it out so that it isn't just the most motivated people. And to your point, Anne, about that, how that gets weighted, she said it won't be weighted. However, it will be analyzed by different demographics so that one can see the differences of, for instance, different age groups. There is a question of what questions are included on the survey, and that's where Parks and Rec Commission wanted to be able to participate, because if there is no question on there about, do you care, do you think we should prioritize things for seniors, if it's only do you think we should prioritize for homeless, for instance, or fire or whatever, all the different needs, we just want to make sure that there's a place for people to show what their interests are. And then we want to be partners in making sure it reaches many constituencies. The last thing I will say is, given Mike's comment, I do wonder whether we do need a motion and a vote about a letter, because as staff and Mike as the chair, we need to know that we're representing the opinion here. So I wouldn't know how to craft it given the diversity of opinion right now.
Go ahead, Anne.
Well, I think one of the things that's tricky about saying anything about seniors is that there's always a sense that we're talking about services for seniors, when in fact, senior needs affect the entire family. We're seeing this a lot with working adults who cannot work because they're caregiving for children or caregiving for older adults. And so I don't know how, you know, depending on how they phrase a question, do you think seniors are our priority? Do you see how that can be skewed to seem like, you know, we want grandma to have special benefits because she worked hard all of her life, when that is not, I think, where we're coming from with senior issues. So I think the crafting of the questions is very important. And I think we should have a seat at the table, if not just for the senior advisory committee, but the work group of the senior advisory committee, which is the Livable Ashland Committee, which involves the hospital, the university, the libraries, all these groups that are interested in livability for everyone. And how they ask those questions makes a huge difference.
Right. I'm going to let Steph have a comment.
I would just say that understanding our demographics is also important, because the senior population in Ashland is a larger population, especially the over 85, than it is nationally or even in Oregon. So we're not really talking about a small special interest group, we're talking about a large part of our population.
So I'm just going to say this right now, we're probably going to run over past 5 o'clock, and anybody that needs to leave or wants to leave is welcome to. I think we still have a few things to get done, and this is an important question. Once again, just refocusing, the survey, as I understand it, is going to be a survey regarding what citizens of Ashland want to fund. It's really based around the general fund, which is what's hurting in the city right now. The general fund doesn't have enough money to cover all the particular programs and services that it's trying to cover. So once again, that's going to be the focus of the survey, to try to prioritize what's important, what isn't. Is fire and police more important than parks? Is, you know, it would lead you to, you know, if the senior program is part of APRC, is that important to make sure that APRC is funded so that we can have the senior program and the nature center and the other facilities that people in town cherish and expect to be able to use. So that was a little convoluted, but I just wanted to say that, and Sandy has her hand up. So go ahead, Sandy.
I just want to say that, excuse me, I'm using a different device than I usually use. So I don't know why the head is so big, but I do think it's important that we are able to take a look at how these questions are phrased. And so I would support something from us saying that we would like to be at the table or have some input into how the questions are phrased. And it kind of, in a way, goes along with what you were just saying, Michael, because if it's just like a checklist without any explanation, for one thing, if it's parks, people don't all know that senior services are included in that. So I think it's important that we know that at least there's an option for people to say that this is important for them. I don't know, just a thought.
I guess the way I could kind of wrap this up is that the Ashland Park and Rec Commissioners will be discussing this letter to the council, the request to be included in the questioning process at Wednesday night's meeting. And I guess to start off, I would bring your concerns to the commission to see if it can be logged in there with whatever we send to council is the best I can do right now. So I don't know if anybody has a comment on that, but go ahead, Ann.
Are these questions going to be, what do you think about parks versus police and fire? Or are they going to be under parks? How do you feel about the nature center, the trails, the bike paths, the senior program? In other words, there are many things under parks.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah.
The council hasn't got the questions. The SOU hasn't even formulated the questions yet. So the way I understood it from Councilor Graham is the SOU group is going to formulate a group of questions, and then the council is going to review those questions and make sure they're worded and cover the areas that they want covered. And what APRC, what the commission is asking, is going to ask, is can we be part of that process to make sure that the important programs that are under APRC are part of that survey, so that it isn't just, you don't just think of Lithia Park when you think of funding APRC, but you think of the programs that are involved with it. But really, there's no questions yet, and I'm the council really is unclear what the whole process is going to be as well. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Oh yeah, thank you. What I was going to say is that I think it's important also, not as a special interest, but as a citizen of Ashland, to look at and to try to explain the importance of a park system, of a trail system, to our economic well-being, to the fact that we're not a outward bound. We inbuilt here, and there's going to be less garages, less any usable places for there to be pets or children to play. So those kind of factors are also really important for people to understand in why open space is important and why stewardship is important to develop people that will care about the environment or the climate, for example.
Yeah.
Deborah has her hand up.
Who does?
Deborah.
Oh, okay. I didn't. Go ahead, Deborah. Sorry.
No, I just wanted to clarify, and maybe I think Stephanie or Mike, we could. Are the results of this survey going to impact the decision as well about whether the parks becomes a separate entity or remains under the city, or is that a whole separate issue?
It's really a separate issue, but it's related to funding, but how that funding is addressed is a little different. You know, the discussion around a park district versus a park commission versus parks as a department of the city, that's kind of a different discussion after the council gets done with this survey, which is supposed to be helping them determine what the citizens want funded and what they don't want funded.
I just want to say goodbye, and I'm leaving. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mike.
Talk to you later, Mike. So I'm sorry that the meeting ran over. You know, I think this is an ultimately important subject, and we probably could have spent a whole hour and a half on discussing it. So I'm not trying to sell it short by moving on to anything else, but I think if nothing else, I think even though Steph, I know, agrees with us, I think you heard it from us as far as, you know, hoping that there will be some inclusion in the process to make sure that the, you know, results reflect at least this group's concern about seniors in Ashland and representation. But I don't really have anything else to add to this discussion. Is there any other comments or questions? Okay. Natalie and Eileen, did you want to go ahead and give a brief update on your sections of this?
I just wanted to name our two upcoming special educational presentations. They're both on Zoom still, but in January we have one of our instructors doing like a preview of a class she's teaching on yoga for chronic pain management. And it's actually a program that is for 18 and above, but we kind of took it on thinking that most of the participants are probably going to be 15 and above, which is our client population. And that is a paid course. So she's giving sort of like a free presentation so people can see if that's a good fit for them. That'll help ensure that the class won't have to be canceled. And then in February, I am partnering with a colleague who works for the Recreation Department of the City of Troutdale in Oregon. And since we have both lived and worked in Africa, we're going to be doing a presentation kind of travelogue, because we thought that would be kind of fun and pretty easy when we can rely on staff to present. And beyond that, we're still in the planning stages for more monthly educational presentations.
Great. Excellent. Thank you.
So all of mine is in my written report. I do just want to highlight a couple things briefly. One is the good news that I was able to find out Ashland Connector does plan to come back. They've only stopped Ashland Connector because of staffing. But when they took down our sign in front of the senior center, we freaked out and thought maybe they weren't going to bring it back. But it will come back. They just have eased up their restrictions on where they'll pick up and drop people. So they have very few of those signs up anymore. Mostly they'll go wherever someone wants. So that was good news. And I wanted to let you know, we had heard in earlier meetings about the Walker Elementary construction. That construction is going on now.
And we should have our reserved parking signs installed behind me here on Hunter Court in the next couple weeks. So things are in progress. And other than that, the reopening is sort of what it's about, but you can read all about it in my report. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Eileen. Sorry that we didn't give you enough time.
That was plenty. Thank you.
So Sandy and Ann, Livable Ashland.
Well, this is Sandy. This will be real quick. We did meet and had some conversation about what the different groups are doing and where we can get some synergy. So we continue kind of on the path that we've been on for a while. I think that's enough.
I would just add that I'm encouraged by some of the developments that are being spurred by the conversations among the steering committee members. And yeah, it's moving slowly, but it has a lot of potential. That's positive news.
Yeah. And, you know, you and I spoke earlier today. I like the idea of really wrapping it into kind of even more what this survey that the council is going to be doing. I don't understand it all yet, but it, you know, as you two bring it to us and I think more about it, I just see the value of it in the community and really a core value of our community. So hopefully
it's hard to argue with livability.
Yeah, I mean, you know? It really is. Well, thanks for that. Hopefully the next meeting we'll have we'll give you your full allotment of time and we can hear more from you. Any other items from other ASAC members that wasn't covered today? Okay,
I'm not sure everybody knows, but this is a time if there's a future agenda item that somebody would like, something that we haven't been discussing, this is a great place on the agenda to bring that up so that we can calendar it in a future agenda.
You know, and I think there would be hopefully some feedback from the council with the, you know, with the survey process. Not that it's going to be a big issue for us, but I definitely would hope that we could have an update on that if, you know, as that process moves forward. Even though we're not meeting till March, I would hope that things would probably be in the works and advancing by 2 months from now. But
I was just going to say that too, because, you know, if there is something that we need to be aware of, I think you guys are pretty good about letting us know. So hopefully that will happen.
Yeah. Go ahead, Anne, or go ahead, Steph.
If you want me to give any sort of report at the next council meeting, and if you have any wording you'd like me to use so that I'm reflecting what is most important for the council to hear, I'd be happy to do that.
That would probably be on the 18th then, or the 17th, 18th. Yeah. Okay. We can discuss that with Eileen and see what we can come up with.
Thanks.
That'd be good. Thanks.
I would just like to mention that we have a Livable Ashland meeting on February 9th or something. I don't know. It's coming up in February. And I'm just wondering if it would be worthwhile to have, if there's somebody on council that is specifically assigned to the process, maybe that's Tanya or whatever, is to perhaps have invite that person to Livable Ashland. I don't know, we can talk about that, Sandy, but I mean, it might just be worthwhile for them to realize how this entity is affecting a lot of livability issues, or has the potential to affect them, and to reflect that in the survey. So I don't know, it's to be discussed.
Yeah, that's a good point, for sure. Anything else from members? Okay, Well, the next our next meeting is scheduled for March 14th, Monday, March 14th, and I'm going to suspect that we'll probably be Zooming again, even though I know the desire of some is to meet in person, but I'm going to say that we can probably count on Zoom for March, and kind of see where COVID goes and where the really it's more important to find out what the city is doing as far as in-person meetings. So, but I appreciate everyone's input today. I thought the program was very informative, and both Linda Reed and Eileen and Natalie, your update as well. I think internally we might send some emails around regarding our interaction with the council on this survey issue. So hopefully we'll be able to keep members up to date on how it moves forward. So other than that, I have nothing else, and I will adjourn the meeting. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and thanks for your participation.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.